It's been a gray summer for publishing. The runaway bestseller, 50 Shades of Grey, and related titles in the E.L. James trilogy from Vintage have reportedly sold over 10 million copies. That sensational figure suggests there's a ready-to-ride bandwagon for other publishers. We get the bare facts and discover that Jane Eyre is getting a makeover. Hold on to your hoop skirt. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and every week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, preview of the news that everyone in publishing is talking about. And joining me from PW's New York office is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor. Welcome back, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
It's good to have you join us again here in the midst of some of the dog days of summer, but hardly the dog days for at least one publisher, Vintage. They are enjoying quite a run with 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, you know you've hit it big when the knockoffs start rolling in. So it's official. 50 Shades of Grey is no longer just a book. It is a full-fledged publishing phenomenon. And you know that because, as the saying goes, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. And in Monday's issue, our Rachel Deal looks at the knockoff effect 50 Shades of Grey has launched. You know, I wouldn't have thunk it, Chris, but publishers are suddenly seem to be hoping that books with a good S&M hook are going to appeal to a whole new audience uncovered by 50 Shades of Grey. And the question many in the industry are now asking is, you know, where are these 50 Shades of Grey readers going to turn next? And let's be clear, as you mentioned in your intro, there are a lot of 50 Shades readers out there. According to BookScan, the trilogy has sold over 10 million copies, and that includes the box set, which is, you know, priced around $50. So you're going to want to read Rachel's story to get all of the juicy details about this. But it's clear that publishers are beginning to look for that next, you know, 50 Shades of Grey thing. And so far, Sylvia Day's book, Bared to You, which now sits at number 6 on the romance bestseller list, looks to be seizing the mantle. Like E.L. James's novel, Day's book was also self-published, interestingly enough. And it was acquired by Penguin's Berkeley imprint, I think in late May. And what's also interesting is that Penguin's marketing is claiming that the book will speak directly to the 50 Shades reader. So you've got even a direct connection to 50 Shades there in the marketing materials. And the Berkeley cover, by no coincidence, I'm sure, features a pair of cufflinks, which recalls the sort of stark image of a tie on the Vintage edition of 50 Shades of Grey. But as you also mentioned, my favorite development, and what I think really speaks to the massive success of James's books, Indie House Skyhorse announced last month that it is launching a mashup series that is going to insert erotic elements into the classics. So suffice it to say, thanks to E.L. James, Jane Eyre is going to get a little hotter in the coming months.
That's right. Well, I'm thinking about all the possibilities here. I understand there's also going to be a title that brings together Sherlock and Watson in a way we have never seen them before. But I guess finally, you know, the opening line in Pride and Prejudice about a young man in possession of a fortune is in want of a wife, but it turns out he might have wanted something else.
It's going to be more fun than zombies. We'll put it that way.
That's right. All right. Well, speaking of things heating up, there are some more developments in the legal cases you've been following for us, particularly the Apple DOJ suit.
True, true. And at this point, I think it's fair to say that we're steaming along toward approval of a settlement between S.S. Hachette and HarperCollins and the Department of Justice in their price-fixing case. The parties have until next Wednesday, August 15th, to file a response to the government motion for approval, and then the government has another week till August 22nd to file its reply to the publishers. But suffice it to say that the three settling publishers are not going to file anything with a court that's going to scuttle their deal, as much as they might internally bristle at the DOJ's assessment of the facts in this case. But I think the most interesting development this week concerned the ABA and Barnes & Noble. You'll recall last week we spoke about the ABA and Barnes & Noble filing a motion asking the court for permission to file a friend of the court or an amicus brief opposing the settlement. Judge Cote said yes, but in an interesting twist this week, she determined that the two organizations' motion in which they, you know, asked for permission to file a brief, that would actually serve as the brief. In other words, Cote determined that in the ABA B&N brief seeking permission, that they didn't really put forward an argument about why they should be able to file an amicus brief. Rather, they put forward an argument against the final judgment. So just like that, presto, she made that motion the amicus brief. You know, we've had a few reads on what that might mean, but my opinion that is it's not really a good sign for ABA and BNN. You know, they did make a really good case in their motion as to why the settlement was going to harm them, but is that the argument they really would have made had they had two more weeks to put together another amicus? Probably not. And I think the new brief likely would have allowed them to at least hone their argument better. So to my mind, making this their brief asking permission to file an amicus, the actual amicus brief, is akin to saying, you know, yeah, I get it. Settlement bad. And I'm fully expecting a pretty quick decision on the settlement after these motions are all filed.
We'll look forward to that, a settlement finally in something. We've had so many cases just sort of dragging on, and getting this over with might not be a bad thing for publishers, all things considered.
Yeah, you know, maybe not, because this week both HarperCollins and SNS released their fourth quarter and fiscal 2012 results, and lo and behold, they did okay. But legal costs, specifically costs tied to this action, held them back. You know, I look at that and I just want to say, you know, way to go, DOJ, right? Here we are in the teeth of an industrial transition with a sputtering economy, and we have significant money being diverted away from authors and the publishing of books and into lawyers' pockets. And I have to wonder if it really had to go this way. And here's the thing, even with quick approval of this settlement, those lawyers are going to continue to do well. Because remember, there's still the consumer class action and estate settlement out there. And, you know, let's not kid yourself, the settling publishers are almost certainly going to get dragged into the court fight between the non-settling publishers, Macmillan and Penguin, and the Department of Justice. You know, there's going to be some documents turned over and testimony, et cetera. So this is not going to be over for them. You know, we have a deadline next week in the DOJ settlement talks, but the reality is this ordeal is, you know, even if the settlement is approved quickly, the reality is this ordeal is not going to be over anytime soon, I'm afraid.
Well, despite your protestations, I should say, no sympathy for those lawyers, as you mentioned. They will be doing very well indeed. And someone else who's done very well in book publishing is J.K. Rowling. We talked about her battles with piracy last week, and in Monday's issue, piracy returns.
That's right. Very interesting story. You know, this in Monday's issue, we have a column from our contributing editor, Cory Doctorow, on the subject of DRM. For those of you who need a refresher, and that's probably not many of you at this point, Cory is very much against the use of DRM, and he has a very good argument. You know, it doesn't stop piracy, he says, which I think a lot of people are finding to be true, and it does enable the platform lock-ins for competitors like Amazon, which makes it very unfriendly to consumers who can't switch formats without abandoning their ebooks. Well, this week, Corey writes about a letter that he's come across from Hachette in the UK to an author whose territorial rights they'd acquired. In the letter, signed by Hachette UK CEO Ursula McKenzie, the publisher notes that Tor, which controls rights to the author's books in other territories, is, you know, apparently jeopardizing Hachette's ability to exploit its rights in its own territories by not using DRM. You know, you'll recall that Tor abandoned DRM earlier this year. Well, now Hachette is basically saying to this author that, you know, Tor's putting its editions out there without DRM is leading to piracy, and that's affecting what we can do in our territory. That's a pretty bold argument and a pretty brash move by Hachette, I must say, trying to exert influence over publisher policy in other territories where they don't control rights. And you'll not be surprised that Corey has a lot to say about this, and also more about why DRM doesn't really work to stop piracy. So you really won't want to miss this column. And also, I have to add one thing. I think it speaks to the thorny issue surrounding territorial rights in the digital age, you know, on a larger scale. Because after all, it is a World Wide Web, is it not?
It is indeed. And we are always happy to be on that very World Wide Web with Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Thanks again for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you, Chris.
Now I'd like to turn to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris.
And you've brought, as always, a batch of books for us. Tell us more.
So the reviews in the upcoming edition of Publishers Weekly start with a Q&A in the fiction section with Tatiana Soli. She's the author of the award-winning and best-selling debut novel, The Lotus Eaters. And this Q&A is about her new book, The Forgetting Tree. She told us about the pressure of following up a successful debut and her life in Southern California in a neighborhood once known for its orange groves. And these groves, now lost to urban sprawl, are what inspired Soli's new novel, which is about a character that's really attached to the land. We also cover Silent House. This is the first English translation of an early novel by Orhan Pamuk. We say this book never achieves the richness and depth of the author's later work. It's about a nonagenarian widow who's living in a derelict villa in a seaside village near Istanbul, and she arrived there as the teenage bride of a much older man, an alcoholic, who sold off her jewelry to support his writing of a 48-volume set of encyclopedias intended to prove to his countrymen that God does exist. So there's a whole lot in this story. And despite its flaws, the novel deftly suggests the political strife that roiled Turkish society before the coup in 1980. Readers who expect another taut literary thriller in the line of Smilla's Sense of Snow are in for a surprise with Peter Hugg's new novel. We call it a thriller of sorts. It's called The Elephant Keeper's Children, and it's more humorous than frightening, more of a caper than a mystery, and more of a coming-of-age story than a suspense yarn. Narrated by a precious 14-year-old boy, this is a shaggy dog tale full of digressions, adolescent humor, and philosophical musings.
Well, as we turn to mysteries, Rose, I think I hear a foghorn off in the distance.
Oh, you're probably hearing that from Victoria Jenkins's Unattended Death, which is set on Washington State's Puget Sound. In this crime novel, Irene Chavez, a detective in the Mason County Sheriff's Department, looks into the suspicious death of a psychiatrist who's found floating in an inlet. And Irene is a logger's daughter, and she struggles to overcome her prejudice against the wealthy as she interviews members of the victim's family. Fans of Stieg Larsson's Lisbeth Salander will cotton to Detective Constable Fiona Griffiths. She's the damaged heroine of British author Harry Bingham's Talking to the Dead. She's an expert at paperwork, and she manages to worm her way into a homicide case of a woman with a history of drugs and prostitution. Fiona's habit of spending time with the corpses in the morgue may be bizarre, but Bingham makes this quirk a believable and thoughtful way for her to process clues. And we have a Q&A with GM Malliette, who's the author of A Fatal Winter. This is the second in the Max Tudor Cozy series. Malliette describes the difficulties of finding an agent, even after she had published a number of well-received mysteries with a reputable small house.
Several horror novels stand out this week.
Yeah, in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror section, we're really all about the horror. Of course, we're covering late fall books, and Halloween is always a good time for horror novels. So we have John Ivied Lindquist's new book, Little Star. Lindquist is best known for Let Me In, which became the movie Let the Right One In. In his first couple of books that were translated into English, focused on the supernatural. But this one is more about the ways that people mistreat one another and the horror that we can generate for ourselves. And the focus is on a young girl with a talent for singing and a penchant for gory murder. So every aspect of bad behavior among humans is on display here. There are abusive parents, casual thugs, and the psychological brutality of performance competitions. Horror fans will also be excited to see a new novel from Glenn Hirschberg. Motherless Child is actually the story of two young mothers who are turned into vampires and fear they won't be able to restrain themselves from harming their own children. So one of them asks her mother to take the kids far away and leave no trace. And Hirschberg is just a terrific writer. He really deserves to be much better known, and he brilliantly contrasts the mother's longing for their children and the vampiric craving for blood. In romance this week, it's all about men who fight and women who heal. We cover Hardcore by Jennifer Lowry, in which a professional mercenary is wounded while tracking down a purveyor of stolen organs. He's nursed back to health by a doctor who happens to be the same doctor who has, under duress, been harvesting those organs from healthy people. And in Saving the Rifleman by Julie Rowe, a British soldier trapped in Belgium during World War I must get crucial information back to the British command, and he's helped out by a Belgian nurse who shares his hatred for the Germans. Both titles contain plenty of action and drama as well as romance.
Well, turning to nonfiction, Rose, I think I see a book by Oliver Sacks, but is that my imagination?
Well, it might be hard to tell. Oliver Sacks' new book is just called Hallucinations, and he talks about seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, or just sensing things that aren't there. We think of this as a sign of madness, but it's really very common. So Sacks investigates a wide range of hallucinations, from the geometric zigzags of a migraine and the painful cramps of phantom limbs to florid multi-character melodramas, grotesque phantasms, and mystic trances induced by brain disorders and and drugs. And Sacks is writing with his trademark mix of evocative description, probing curiosity, and warm empathy as he once again draws back the curtain on the mind's improbable workings. We also cover In the Physics of Wall Street, A Brief History of Predicting the Unpredictable by UC Irvine professor James Owen Weatherall, and he looks at the role played by physicists and their ideas in financial markets, and he argues persuasively that their contribution should be more widely used and recognized. Weatherall suggests that the profession's essential contribution to finance is to develop models of how financial markets operate using insights from science. If that sounds a little dense, don't worry. Even laymen can enjoy the sketches of eccentric theoreticians and his examples of unexpected patterns gleaned from such seemingly unrelated fields as the study of migratory salmon and the discovery of nylon. Now that David Foster Wallace's unfinished novel The Pale King has been published posthumously, we begin the inevitable trawl of his uncollected writings, and as is the case in this collection, both flesh and not, it will inevitably yield both dingers and duds. On subjects ranging from the U.S. Open to Zbigniew Herbert, the AIDS virus to Terminator 2, yet again, Wallace's genuine and infectious love for obsessive human endeavors is on display. The opening essay, Federer, Both Flesh and Not, by itself is worth the price of the book. Also in nonfiction, we have Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe. Marvel Comics, as I think probably most people know, is a comic book publisher that spawned roughly half of Hollywood's summer franchises, but it has plenty of melodrama of its own in the scintillating history. Howe is a journalist who recounts the saga of Stan Lee and the other creators who broke the square-jawed and earnest mold to create quirky, neurotic, rough-edged superheroes with a pop art look, including Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, and the X-Men. Howe's exploration of the vast Marvel universe with its crazily grandiose plots and thousands of bizarre characters is affectionate and incisive. Like comic books, his narrative often goes in circles, and the same antagonisms keep churning away on successively grander platforms. But he paints an indelible portrait of the crass, juvenile, soulful business that captured the world's imagination. And finally, in nonfiction, we cover This Machine Kills Secrets, How WikiLeakers, Cypherpunks, and Hacktivists Aim to Free the World's Information. And this is by Andy Greenberg, and he includes a rogues list of the hackers and cypherpunks who have decided to reveal classified materials and confront the might of the U.S. government. So he starts with Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, goes all the way through to WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange. As leaked secrets have covered such things as dark military endeavors, Wall Street mishaps, personal moral defects, and executive cover-ups. So he mostly focuses on Assange and the inner workings of the secretive WikiLeaks, but Greenberg also fully examines the historical development of cryptographic code and online whistleblowing, along with the ongoing skirmish of NSA versus the dedicated hackers.
Well, you know, I love it, Rose, when the title in nonfiction always proves that truism about truth and fiction. And that one certainly has a lot of elements that could only, you just couldn't make them up. In children's books, what do we got?
We have a big spread in the picture book section, 14 sequels and additions to popular series for young readers. Also in picture books, we cover Island, A Story of the Galapagos by Jason Chin, who's the author of Coral Reefs. He does more than just explain how species of reptiles and birds have evolved, but begins with the birth of the islands themselves, starting with volcanic eruptions punching holes in the Earth's surface as tectonic plates move over them. And he sets it against changes in the island's climate and geology over many millennia as he discusses the adaptations of the island's animals, and also covers Darwin's work for the discussion of the Galapagos finches and the trend towards stronger beaks. Some also clarify that the larger seeds a stronger beak can crack are all that's left as the islands subside and droughts become more common. Other changes are also attributable to climate. Tortoise shells develop a saddleback shape that's better for keeping cool and navigating the desert. So Chin's artwork features rich color, inviting detail, and a dynamic balance between small serial panels and majestic spreads. It's really a remarkable work and an asset for educators who are struggling to present material about evolution in a balanced way that's age-appropriate. Explicating scientific content this gracefully and clearly is no small achievement. In children's fiction, we have Sophia's War, A Tale of the Revolution by Avi, who's a Newbery medalist for Crispin, the Cross of Lead. Avi channels the mood, language, and danger of the Revolutionary War in this seamless blend of history and fiction that's set in British-occupied New York City. 12-year-old Sophia Calderwood idolizes her older brother, who's a fervent patriot soldier who has gone missing after the Battle of Brooklyn. So first she searches for him in several deplorable prisons where rebels are being held, and then she becomes a spy who uncovers the truth about Benedict Arnold. So the book is chock full of fascinating historical details, including the conditions for those stranded in New York and the failed meetings between Benedict Arnold and John André, his real-life British contact. Avi doesn't sugarcoat the brutal realities of war as Sophia races to find help intercepting John André, who was also a boarder in her home years earlier, and her first crush. So the combination of the political and the personal makes this a really rich, nail-biting thriller. We also cover The Odyssey by Gillian Cross, illustrated by Neil Packer. This is a stunning and heavily illustrated retelling in which Cross gives shivery life to Homer's saga, keeping the suspense taut and recounting the story's most disturbing events without flinching. When the Laestrygonians slaughter boatloads of Odysseus's men, the survivors are horror-struck, described as sobbing with grief and shock. When Odysseus travels to the land of the dead, ghosts crowd around. Not until the final pages do the gods allow him a measure of triumph. And Cross's prose makes Odysseus's journey not just accessible, but thrilling. And Packer's images look like the friezes on the sides of Greek craters. Others are full-color portraits of gaunt warriors with haunted gazes or caricatures of their Bosch-like adversaries. So this is really a monumental piece of work. And in children's nonfiction, we cover Bomb, The Race to Build and Steal the World's Most Dangerous Weapon by Steve Shenkin. This is a really highly readable sort of storytelling style of nonfiction. It weaves together scientific and technological discovery, back alley espionage, and wartime sabotage in a riveting account of the race to build the first atomic weapon. So there's a real suspenseful play-by-play moment along with black and white portraits of key players in photo montages. He pulls from numerous sources to supply every chapter with quotations that swiftly move the narrative forward. And he ends it by saying, "It's a story with no end in sight, and like it or not, you're in it." So this is really a must-read for students of history and science. Finally, we turn to the online annex. Tim Gunn's Fashion Bible, The Fascinating History of Everything in Your Closet, is exactly what it claims to be. Here, the frank fashion mentor from the reality show Project Runway combines his signature brand of sassy wisdom with a smart and entertaining journey through the history of fashion, from simple unmentionables to the haute couture statement pieces. Gunn covers it all in this fun and informative survey. And we have a review of Brian Carpenter and Tom Franklin's Grit Lit, A Rough South Reader. This anthologizes the subgenre, known for its bleak, violent, and sometimes blackly funny stories of poor Southern white folks for the first time. It features Rough South mainstays Barry Hanna and Dorothy Allison, along with lesser-known writers like Anne Pancake and newcomer Alex Taylor. It goes from realism to postmodernism, from Southern Gothic to country noir. Gritlit showcases the genre's breadth and depth.
And finally, Rose, we've got a pick of the week that sounds like it would appeal to a lot of animal lovers.
Yeah, this is The Life and Love of Cats by Lewis Blackwell, who's a writer and photographer. His previous book was The Life and Love of Trees. And this is a nice, peaceful book to curl up with on one of those fall evenings. He examines the special connection humans have with cats of every shape and size. Over the course of 9 chapters, which I guess are the book's 9 lives, he illustrates how our relationship with cats has had implications far beyond the immediately obvious. It talks about the correlation between cats and witchcraft, which led to a steep decline in feline populations during the Middle Ages, which then allowed rats to flourish and thereby facilitated the rapid spread of the Black Plague. But as good as Blackwell's text is, the true appeal of the book is stunning images. They're beautifully composed portraits of Abyssinians, Bengal tigers, sphinxes, Persians, and more, as well as close-ups of paws, eyes, tongues, and whiskers. Blackwell covers everything from napping kitties to the majestic Black Panther and the noble White Tiger, but this is definitely more than a bound calendar. Any cat lover or fan of top-notch photography will thoroughly appreciate this thoughtful and creative large format book.
Well, and thank you for that, Rosa. And you know, you just made a connection for me that I was unaware of, the notion that the Black Death and the rats that brought it may have come about because of the superstition around cats and witches. Fascinating. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville, joins us every week with the review of the week's reviews. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For everyone at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.